I'm delighted to welcome you, Wolfgang Pöscher. Is a philosopher. He teaches at the Philosophical Institute of the University of Vienna. Last year, you were also at the IKKM in Weimar, the International Research Institute for Cultural Technologies and Media for Philosophy, at the Bauhaus University, Weimar. Something else I should perhaps mention in the context of this conference is that Wolfgang Pöscher in 2000 was also the curator of an exhibition entitled The Social Machine, Money. That brings me to my first question. In Weimar at the IKKM, you had a project, I believe it may be ongoing. You entitled it The Space of Money, and you focused on the notion of the cultural technology or technique of money. Perhaps you could shed some light on these notions for us. Well, partly it was because of the general topic of the IKKM, place and spaces and how these come into being. And I thought that I would look at Assyrian silver trade. I had to present this in English as well. It was part of a project in which cultural techniques and technologies such as reading, writing, and accounting could be traced back to the precise technique at the end of the 19th century, the price notion of engineering in the 19th century, the impact of the engineer on agriculture, particularly in irrigation technology. If you trace this back through history, then in a sense, you come to the roots and origins of our civilization, with a few reservations nonetheless, but it lies in irrigation. If you look at Mesopotamia, you might wonder when you ought to focus the time period 3000 before Christ. It wasn't just in Mesopotamia, it was also the case in Ukraine at the same time. So in Mesopotamia, there was something positive, or perhaps it's unpleasant. They used to write on clay tablets, which are well preserved in that climate. And there's a surfeit of documents. It's used as well to look at the notion of money. David Graeber pushed back money to that point in time as well in his book. In these initial early clay tables, what you find primarily, say 90, 95%, are economic matters, particularly quantitative descriptions thereof. Figures are used. And that's the start of writing. It doesn't narrate something, but there's enumeration of workers' rations, warehouse stores, tribute payments, most likely. And very soon, too, you find relationships of debt being recorded as well. And of course, that's important in terms of memory because they extend over time. It's also very striking as a legal document which can be made available to recall to others the debts that they owe to you. And that then gave rise to interest. The first documentation of interest is in a dispute between two states relating to a lease and to agricultural land. An enormous interest arose because of this land dispute. And at the same time as this was created, relief from debt or forgiveness of debt was created generally after the First or Second year of a king's rule, they said that all debt on, so to speak, consumer credits would be forgiven, not business debts, but consumer debts for consumer loans. And in Mesopotamia, this became standard practice. And that was also transposed into Judaism, the idea of forgiving debts every 7 years. And it's a very interesting fact that with the invention of interest, you also had the invention of debt forgiveness for social reasons. And this is a cultural technology which derives from this Mesopotamian realm. Irrigation was created, a canal between the Euphrates and Tigris, indeed an entire canal system that meant that very productive agriculture came into being solely, or primarily at least, because of this irrigation system. That made it possible for an elite to be fed who were no longer directly involved in the work of irrigation, but started to administer that work. And from that administrative work, they derived the legitimacy for permanent payments, first of all, to the temple administration and the palace administration. And I would assume that this whole religious narrative was created by them too, which was handed down and handed down and handed down. Texts copied and copied, for example, the Old Testament, because of the time when the Jews were in Babylon in imprisonment. They copied texts. For example, the Hadduk myth is the source for Genesis. The Babylonians came out of Assyrian capture and took their statue with them. That's, exactly, in a sense, exactly the same narrative as Genesis' legitimacy for the creation myth came from the Babylonian text. Anyway, these are highly ideological narratives, of course, and they establish a vertical relationship that is irrecoverable, as Henaf cited in his book, unfortunately, without any expansive discussion of this. Sedentary societies create debt. They take on board successful cultural technologies which create an excess. They're very productive and they're grateful to the ancestors, and they extend this back, they extrapolate it backwards, and you find a divinity. You can think of the water games in Mesopotamia with the two water divinities. That's not so directly germane, but the same narrative comes into being. How do you get order coming out of chaos? Who represents order? The elite creates order, and the elite must therefore be paid. So it's actually the elite who is always owed something. And they, in a sense, reflect the notion of something being owed to the ancestors or to the divinity. So that the aristocracy pretends that it's owed to the god, so that's to conceal their actual role. Now, moving on to the 19th century, the text that I read in particular for today's meeting related to John Stuart Mill, that was the text you sent me, relates to one of the British thinkers on political economy, and there was a move from the honourable notion of credit to lady credit in Daniel Defoe. Defoe addresses this in two distinct texts, but in very different ways. On the one hand, and he seems to agree with a number of writers in England at the time, credit is the blood of trade. We come back to the notion of blood, which has been cited repeatedly today. The lifeblood of trade, the marrow, these highly biological metaphors, and as something that's eminently related to English nationalism. But then there's the other description of Lady Credit. She's described as being a whore, not to beat about the bush. Now, you address this transition from the honorable credit. You describe the change in significance of this term credit or loan, honorable credit to the hoor credit. Could you maybe tell us a little bit more about this transformative process, this change? What happened exactly there? Well, there are narratives which probably came into being in Italy where a credit figure is dead. You see this on pamphlets in the 16th, 17th century. Credit is dead precisely because people could no longer pay back and no longer did pay back. And then all of a sudden you find lady credit popping up in England. And that relates to public debt, government debt, after the founding of the Bank of England, which turned private debt into public debt and provided guarantees. Now, I think that we need to bear in mind there was probably a transition from what English historians call the credit culture that permeated almost the entire culture of the 16th and 17th century. The royal family, right down to the very lowest ranks of society, was involved in relationships of reciprocal obligations for various reasons. That's partly because the money in circulation could not keep up with the increase in consumption. That's because the coins were in precious metals. Greg Muldrow's estimated that the need for money increased by 500%, and the actual production only went up by 36%. So there's a big discrepancy there. In Italy, this was the case as well. So classically, what's done then is that people avoid hard currency and instead have written agreements, credit relationships with a kind of clearing house system, a settlement system. But there's a transition from that credit culture, was a kind of a folklore culture, very regional, face-to-face credits. A merchant keeps a tab for you, for example. And there was a switch via the financial revolution, which was around 1700. When that happened, suddenly the entire perspective changed. There was a move from this very straightforward regional credit. It became a national issue. Nations incur debts through wars, but at the same time, there's a very high level of private wealth. There's also people who profit from war. There's war profiteers. There was the South Sea bubble. After the speculation on the tulips as well, it was mostly a middle-class phenomenon. And then there's the upper echelons of society and parliament, which becomes riddled with corruption. The South Sea companies invented, never existed. And everyone speculates on this. But the shares don't exist. There's the there's the Admiralty that's involved, for example. And the secretary of the South Sea Company plays with the cash and gambles the cash. Everybody's got an interest in keeping the scandal under control because there was so much political corruption. Now, that means that the lady credit, who symbolizes Britannia, becomes a rather debatable figure. In Roxana, Daniel Defoe describes this in this way in which the public sector suddenly takes on the private sector approach. And there's a lot of speculation, the hope of high profit. John Stuart Mill, as we just mentioned, is known very well for his book on liberty. What I'm especially interested in is in the contemporaries of John Stuart Mill, what they would have thought when they heard this title. They would certainly have thought of the slave trade. So I wanted to ask you, the following question. With what kind of urgency was the issue of the slave trade included in the discourse? It would be interesting for me, actually, to know to what extent the international slave trade entered into these discourses circulating around John Stuart Mill, because after all, he's renowned for being the first member of the British Parliament to advocate votes for women. He was very progressive for his time. How then would you slot the international slave trade into the credit business of the late 19th century and the early 19th century above all? Well, I think that the debate had already drawn to a close in the 1830s, actually. There was a move towards a prohibition of the slave trade. On Liberty was written fairly late, in 58, I believe, and furthermore, Harriet Taylor was the main author. He laments her loss, both as a person and as a writer, and he swears that he'll never rewrite the text she was involved in writing on Liberty with him. Now, I would say that there's a discovery or a transfer going on here. There's the harm principle, which is at the core of On Liberty. And there he generalizes what slavery does. He writes on this about women. Subsequently, the whole gender issue is one that he also became aware of through her, and that very strange critiques arose. Freud translated his book, and he wrote, so ridiculous John Stuart Mill is. He thinks that women could take care of themselves, but you don't have any time to do that because they've got to clean and cook and all the rest of it. John Stuart Mill was somewhat more progressive than critics such as that. I mean, quite apart from the other progressive aspects, which Freud may have ignored, I don't really know. Anyway, John Stuart Mill was famous, or indeed notorious, as an economist. 1848, his two-volume work came out on economics. And his approach was not just one of being progressive in moral philosophy, but also in economic terms. Of course, you can't describe him as a neoliberal, but in the Anglo-Saxon sphere, as I'm sure you know better than I do, John Stuart Mill, particularly on Liberty, is always a real landmark text, a real reference text, political discussion, which unfortunately it's not in the German language realm. He's not famous as an economist, nor as a political philosopher, perhaps as a re-import, but he's not really renowned in that. I don't know. What, two more minutes. Let's use them. My question is a big one, too big for 2 minutes, but you cite Georg Simmel, who looked at society as a risk mechanism collective, but also one based on truth. And in the credit economy, lies have a much more existential role than was the case in the past. Now, what I wanted to say, do you think that Simmel's diagnosis is one that still tallies with the current crisis, particularly when you think of future trades, this whole notion of truth and lies? It's perhaps not really entirely appropriate. Well, you can pick up on Defoe as well. He wrote, credit is the most important good that a merchant can sell credibility. If you don't have that kind of credit or credibility, then you've lost out. And that's based on the notion of honest. And that comes from the credit culture from the 17th century. But as transactions become increasingly anonymous, the system becomes more mechanical. Think, for example, of financial mathematics, actuarial calculations. Apparently, the individual decision makers have the burden taken off their shoulders because they're going along with the mainstream. And therefore, it cannot be reprehensible if everyone is doing this. Then what's supposed to be wrong about that? I mean, that's the briefest answer I could give you. Thank you. I'm afraid we've run out of time, but thank you very much.
Cool. Thank you.